go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Over a minute past the hour, and this is a live broadcast from the Horn Studio in the wilds of what's left of once wonderful, now almost level West Virginia. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Horn, headonradionetwork.com, available to you all over the interweb tubes by a variety of platform deliveries, including but not limited to the headonradionetwork.com, headonradionetwork.com site itself, as well as WhiteRoseSociety.org, iTunes Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio, TuneIn Radio, Tuner Internet Radio, and a host of others of which I am probably not aware, but will certainly mention if anybody tells me they're listening via it. Okie dokie. Yeah, I'm a little better. Got the first show under my belt last night. Got that big filibuster out of the way. Talking about the after effects of the derecho. God, what a bunch of foolishness. Big ass storm. This is what we call conversation radio. It depends on your participation. Yeah, or, you know, I've been known to filibuster a little bit as well. I want to thank you for rising to the challenge and meeting Dr. John's challenge last night. Did some some badly needed bill paying yesterday evening. More to be done, more to come. Thank you to those of you who have contributed. And I'll tell you this, I'm going to spend the weekend, some portion of the weekend, getting a lot of thank yous out for what happened over the last 2-3 weeks. It was amazing. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday, however, here on the Horn. Thursdays are reserved for thorns in the side. If Friday wasn't already the Friday on the front porch, it would be Feather in Our Cap Friday. Those, of course, being two references to a frequently referred to book here, namely Joseph Heller's Catch 22. But Thorn in the Side Thursday is reserved for those things that are particularly irksome, little pains in the butt. And I got one. It's very much a personal thing, but it also goes into the larger world of design, engineering, and, well, yeah. Little project that we discovered while the power was out. You know, little projects that you discover while the power is out are generally not fun projects. So this one is occupying my time and Agnes's time. And not pleasurably so. So we've got that for the evening. We got a Romney story. Yeah. And speaking, and this too. Not trying to just be a jerk for being a jerk's sake. But in reading, in going through the story last night about Willard Romney, going, and there's a follow-up to this, too. This is beautiful. Well, no, it's not. But in going through the story about Willard Romney addressing the NAACP National Convention, of course, the observation was made that the NAACP's National Convention was being held in Houston, Texas. So just a quick query to the NAACP. What are you thinking? What are you thinking? Houston? Texas? Really? that's Texas Stan, right? That's a great big meeting that brings a lot of people in to spend money. Wasn't there somewhere that meeting could have been had that wouldn't have poured tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of money into a right-wing corporatocracy oligarchic state like Texas Stan? I'll probably get hate mail from Texas listeners, but I would think that Texas listeners would probably know more than anyone else what I'm talking about. Was it symbolic? I mean, organizations with progressive or semi-progressive or orientations need to not do business inside states that practice repression and racism and bigotry. Don't they? So that's been bothering me. It kind of bubbled to the surface in a conversation I was having off air after the program last night with John Fox, and we were talking about, you know, he's in Australia, but we were talking about what what life is like behind the cornbread curtain. And I was talking about the fact that I would, assuming I had the money. I mean, I've got a list of vehicles I will never buy. Some of them are economic, are choices that are put upon me by virtue of economics. Others are choices that, I don't know, maybe somewhere down the road I might actually think about something along these lines, like a Hyundai. I would never buy a Hyundai. Why? Because they're manufactured in Alabamistan. And I can't support a company with whatever money I have. I can't support a company that chooses to locate a business in a state that practices degrees of repression and oppression, bigotry, racism, and hatred that Alabamistan does. I'd never own one of those M-Class Mercedes-Benz vehicles because it's being manufactured by some dude who's making $13 an hour, has no union and no representation whatsoever down in Alabamistan. The same goes for the BMW crossover SUVs that are manufactured in South Carolina Stan. Low wages, unprotected workers, you know. The Confederacy. I would, frankly, far rather, you know, if I can't get a piece of a vehicle that was made in Detroit by union workers, then you know the next best thing is to support somebody who is a union worker. You know, a German car built in Germany, or a Japanese car built in Japan. Not a Toyota built in Kentucky, Stan. Make any sense? We're propping up economies that are founded upon oppression and repression. And hate, are we not? Just saying. Now, my own little personal slice of hell, I don't know if it has to do, well, it really doesn't have anything to do along those lines. But that little project I was telling you about that we didn't want to get into but wound up getting into involuntarily. Anyone with a history in design it can feel free to wise me up if there's a clear-cut, simple answer to this. Because I'd love to know it. because sitting with all the shelving pulled out of the bottom area of a refrigerator, trying to fix something in it, when, because it's 12 years older, however, as I mentioned last night, no parts are available anymore. Oh, this in from our buddy Jim. Remember the Alamo? The heroic defenders of the Alamo supported slavery. Santa Anna did not. Ironic, is it not? No. Well, it's reality. And that is the historic truth, although I'm sure they don't bring that up in, but Texas Betsy can tell me later, bring that up in, Texas history class. Marty adding, to put the BMW Z4 made in North Carolina or assembled in South Carolina or whatever, add that one to the list. Even if I do win the lottery, right? Toyota built in Canada, Marty? I don't know. The engine may have been built in West Virginia, Stan. And then this coming from Ron and Raleigh. The subject line, tone deaf much? Hey, Bob, remember the Democratic National Convention is going to be held in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yes, that's right, in the right to work for less state of North Carolina. What the hell were they thinking? Oh, cool, repairclinic.com for old appliance parts. I will go and I will look, Ron, because here's what's going on. There's a water line that feeds the ice maker and the cold water dispenser. It comes in from the water supply in a quarter-inch polyethylene line. It comes into a water chiller that looks like a big series of W's. It's a reservoir of sorts. Quarter-inch line in, and the reservoir developed a leak, so that had to go. Because I couldn't think of anything you could use to patch that leak that would still be food grade. Bubble gum did not work, much to my chagrin. Not to mention the fact that it's probably filled with half of the heavy metals end of the periodic table of the elements. I mean, that thing looks nasty. Because we used to have well water running into it. Because the well water around here used to be delightful. Lord, it made the best beer. Oh, it made good beer. So, it goes through this waveform water chiller hickey. And it comes out the other side and heads to the, and there's a line coming off the other side that goes up to the water maker, or the water dispenser and the ice maker. That line, and this is where fun with design and manufacturing comes in, that line is 5/16 of an inch. Just a skosh bigger than a quarter of an inch. But not the same thing by any stretch of the imagination as a quarter of an inch. Boss Man Wayne has often reminded me of the motto, unofficial motto of the carpenters, measure twice, cut once. I measured twice. It ain't the same size. And for the life of me, I don't know why. Yeah, I really, really don't know why. Is it because the fitting for the ice maker was 5/16? And nobody else manufactured an ice maker with a fitting that was quarter inch? I'm baffled. Or is it because somebody in the accounting department got hold of it and said, you know what? We can save 79 cents per refrigerator by manufacturing this with a 5/16 line instead of a quarter inch line because we just got a big bargain on 5/16. I don't know. But it is sheer madness. And profound frustration into the bargain. That was two runs to Lowe's
yesterday. Yes, big box Lowe's because, well, what are you going to do? It's the only game in town. Who were inventoried with all manner of things to help me fix problems that were quarter-inch problems, all set up to help me solve problems that were eighth-inch problems, set up to help me solve problems that were half-inch problems, set up to help me with problems that were 5/16-inch problems, but were not set up to help me join quarter-inch to 5/16. Because after all, why would you ever need to do that? No refrigerator design engineer in his right mind would ever create a situation where you would have to join up a quarter inch to a 5/16. Except they did. My life. Oy. So that's my little personal thorn in the side. Finally found something that we thought would work that was a little brass doohickey. But it wasn't quite right. So the next step in Bob's home improvement, all of these are little lessons for me. The next step may very well be to unplug the son of a gun, pull it out from the wall, roll it around, turn it around to where it can be got at the back. Oh, I don't even want to think about it. Because I'm sure there's no easy way into the back of that refrigerator, and it won't end pleasantly. Of course, this is all designed to... What? Yes, that's right. Make you go out and buy a new refrigerator. Because this is a disposable culture. Ick. So I'm hoping, thank you, Ron, I'm hoping that repairclinic.com, which I have opened now for access later after the program, might be able to help out. So that's just a little personal thorn in the side. And I want to follow up as well this evening with something that Juanita sent me. Juanita has been dealing with some of her own miseries. She and Charles are okay, but she's been a bureaucratic nightmare with the geniuses of local Florida government. It is Dante-esque, to say the least. Last night, she did get to listen, and along the way sent me something I had not seen, namely the USA Today coverage of the situation in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, last week, as Jim Justice insisted that every resource go to making his golf tournament happen. H.Dar Beiser is the correspondent on the piece. You will be shocked by this. No, you won't. This is how the 1% behaves. This is straight up 1% behavior. This is let them eat golf balls. Stunning quotes. The story saying some radio talk show callers in this area, being Greenbrier County, have been critical of emphasis in putting on the tournament. Bear in mind, 400 volunteers were directed to the Greenbrier's Old White golf course to clean up debris after the storm. 400. Some radio talk show callers in this area have been critical of emphasis on in putting on the tournament, but Justice said this region and the state will benefit by hosting it. See, they're job creators for ticket scalpers. He said the post-storm recovery went beyond the damage to the golf course and included getting power and water back to nearby communities where hotels and motels will house spectators. So hotels and motels got power and water back because the precious spectators had to be able to stay in cool, electrified, air-conditioned comfort so they could go out and watch Tiger Woods play on the Old Whitey. Old White, sorry. That's stuck in my head. And then this this quote. Now, we're talking about Jim Justice here, who, as previously noted, has made his billions, or billion, by blowing up mountains, decimating communities, and poisoning men, women, and children, innocent victims of mountaintop removal, and even babies in the womb. That's where his billions came from. They're literally made of flesh and bone. Or lost time being flesh and bone. He made his billion off of shortening people's lives. And naturally, being a member of the 1%, he talks about himself in the third person. No kidding. For this USA Today interview that Juanita sent me, they quoted him. The tournament is probably going to cost $10 million to Jimmy, and who knows how much more in the cleanup, said Justice, speaking in the third person. You know, I should do that some evening, just for the fun of it. Do the entire thing speaking in the third person, just like some sort of novel. I am frustrated with that refrigerator, Bob said. Bob would like to find the person who designed that system, and Bob would then like to beat him senseless with a wad of wet linguine. It would make Bob happy. No, I couldn't do 3 hours of that. The tournament is probably going to cost $10 million to Jimmy. And who knows how much more in the cleanup. Then he switched to the first person, which kind of tells you there might be some psychopathology at work here, but that's not my side of the street. And I've ever wanted out of it is to try to help our state and try to help our people and try to some way quit being 50th among the 50 states. I surely don't want anything out of this for me. It's important for all of us when things get really tough, we don't drop our head. We just say, by dog, we're not going to let it beat us. Let what beat us? The entire reason that West Virginia is 50th in everything, which we're actually not, even though Jimmy likes to say that we are. Jimmy thinks that. Is because of what Jimmy does. Jimmy's a coal baron. Jimmy has poked, prodded, blasted, gouged, and scraped his billion, not just out of the landscape, but out of the lives of West Virginians. He and his minions have treated this state and Appalachia generally like the resource colony that most of the world apparently thinks it is. The storm struck on the 29th of June. It was Friday. July the 3rd was a Tuesday, and the Associated Press reported that day that about 330,000 customers remained without power across West Virginia in the aftermath of the storm. During the weekend, the Greenbrier Resort was without power and water off and on. The number one push of the politicians and the number one push of the power companies has been to take care of those in most need, whether it be hospitals or nursing homes, Justice said. But I can tell they worked hard here as well because of the event and the fact that you can't just cancel the event and have the event in 4 or 5 days. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Among other things, you could move the event to some other venue. I seem to recall, as noted previously, in the aftermath of Katrina that the Sugar Bowl was moved to Atlanta, Georgia, because there was no way to play it inside the Superdome. It wasn't moved upstate to the stadium in Baton Rouge. That's a big stadium there. Probably holds more than the Superdome does. They're on the campus of LSU. Didn't do that. Moved it all the way to Georgia. I remember it because, well, for fans of the West Virginia Mountaineers, it will forever be something very, very special. Watching the Mountaineers just gut stomp the University of Georgia. Oh, sweet. We weren't given a chance. So no, the PGA checkered pants affair could have been moved elsewhere. It's just that it wouldn't have been the balmy ego flush for Jim Justice's psyche if it wasn't his Greenbrier Resort. Storm down trees all over the course. The fairways were littered with debris. The article also notes, of course, that the Greenbrier at one point in time during the Cold War was the home of what was simply referred to as the bunker. And no, we're not talking about a sand trap on number 16 on the Old Whitey, or Old White. It was literally an underground bunker completely set up to house the entire Congress of the United States in case, in the words of Donald Fagan, in case the Reds decide to push the button down. It's been the home of the bunker. It has all kinds of emergency power, backup, all kinds of generators, all kinds of everything, Justice said. So we've been able, for the most part, to keep ourselves up and going. But he said it was vital to get power and water back for nearby communities such as Beckley, where hotels and motels will be housing tournament goers. One of those hotels also had a block of rooms set aside for the participants in the PRISM West Virginia American History Summer Academy. We were going to be broadcasting that live. Would have been happening last week. Would have wrapped up Monday night. And they didn't get it going. They certainly didn't get power to the Irma Bird Center because, you know, giving the brain a workout is not nearly as important as giving people in polyester Dacron blend checkered pants a walk through a golf course so they can watch a good, what Mark Twain called a good walk ruined. Justice finally had to confess where his heart really lay. If you think there's been an emphasis on trying to get power to the tournament or get water to the tournament, well, there's been an emphasis because it's important. The fallout of that emphasis to all the local area hotels, the residents, and everything else is really significant. Well, it was not significant to the octogenarian lady who was a couple of miles or less from the concert venue for Toby Keith that sang about putting boots in asses, who didn't get her power back. The electricity went as far as the concert venue and no further. Oh, yay! This year marks the third Greenbrier Classic. The PGA Tour and the resort announced Tuesday that their original six-year agreement due to run through 2015 had been extended another 6 years through 2021. So if any more derechos blow through, we can get screwed by the one percenters of the golf industry again. After the fact, at his news conference, Jimmy Justice, who sounds a lot like the Jimmy James iron-fisted monkey lion tamer, no, economic lion tamer. Look it up. It's a great segment from news radio. Jimmy Justice sounds a lot like Jimmy James. Sorry, I'm looking for it now. Yeah, there it is. Oh, dear, you know I'm going to do this, don't you? Of course I am. Yeah, we got to have a giggle.
I got a book to get here, and I didn't finish printing it until this morning. So
you haven't seen the book yet?
No, not yet. Whew, sorry to keep you folks waiting, but the book's just got here. So, without any further ado, Jimmy James, CEO of Jimmy James Incorporated, will now read from his book, Jimmy James, Macho Business Donkey Wrestler.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, everybody. The original title of this book was Jimmy James, Capitalist Lion Tamer, but I see now that it's Jimmy James, Macho Business, Donkey Wrestler. You know what it is? I had the book translated into Japanese and back again into English, so... Macho Business, Donkey Wrestler. Well, there you go. Got kind of a ring to it, don't it? Anyway, I wanted to read from Chapter 3, which is the story of my first rise to financial prominence. I had a small house of brokerage on Wall Street. Many days no business comes to my hut. My hut, but Jimmy has fear? 1,000 times no. I never doubted myself for a minute, for I knew that my monkey strong bowels were girded with strength, like the loins of a dragon ribboned with fat and the opulence of buffalo dung. The glorious sunset of my heart was fading. Soon the super karate monkey death car would park in my space. But Jimmy has fancy plans and pants to match. The monkey clown horrible karate, round and yummy, like a cute small baby chick, would beat the donkey. Mr. James Wilbur.
I can't wait for the Jimmy Justice Capitalist Lion Tamer volume to come out. If they'd never turned on the power here, if we'd never had a drop of water, well, I'd have had all of us standing out there holding candles. I'd have tried every way I could, said Jimmy Justice. Macho business donkey wrestler. He went on to say he was grateful that the storm didn't hit the tournament with thousands of fans packed into a community that has a population of about 2,400. You could have had an absolute disaster. You would have had a super disaster. What the... did he think it was? The tournament is probably going to cost $10 million to Jimmy, and who knows how much more in the cleanup before the karate death car comes. But really, that's what happens. The coal barons and the thugs who have made life unbearable in this state chastise us when we have the temerity to ask whether or not it would be better if resources were directed 400 volunteers to clean fallen trees and detritus and limbs off the precious fairways of the old Whitey. I give up. We get chastised for suggesting those volunteers might have done more work making sure that water and ice were delivered to octogenarian ladies who didn't get electricity because the electricity needed to go to Toby, F, and Keith. No, Dr. John, no real word on deaths. Intentionally or otherwise, direct or indirect. In a way, they're hard to measure. Unless you can say that someone died as a direct and proximate cause, well, Jimmy Justice, capitalist lion tamer, will say, hey, it didn't have nothing to do with my golf tournament. It's the same thing that his industry does when we talk about, asthma diagnoses or the various and sundry bizarre cancers that are only supposed to happen once in 100,000 people and pop up five times in a community of 30. Well, it wasn't necessarily coal. It could just be because they're inbred. The National Mining Association, I'll remind you, actually said that about the birth defect study. That birth defect study on mountaintop removal is invalid because the studies refuse to take into account the tendency of Appalachian people to engage in consanguinity. All right. What is this? Pop culture correspondent David from Maine. Bob, I think of this Jimmy whenever third-person issues arise. We'll just take this on the fly. Whatever could it be? Oh, okay. Okay.
Hey, Jimmy! Great game!
Oh, yeah. Jimmy played pretty good.
You know, I felt like we had a synergy out there, you know, like we were really helping each other.
And what do you got there?
These?
Yeah.
These are Jimmy's training shoes.
Yeah. I've seen these things. What are they? They make your legs stronger.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy couldn't jump at all before he got these. Jimmy was like you.
They're plyometric.
Plyometric?
Yeah, they isolate the muscles.
The muscle has to grow.
Or die.
Where do you go? Jimmy sells them.
You sell them?
Oh, yeah. But Jimmy's all out right now. Moving to Manhattan set Jimmy back a bit.
Hey, listen, let me give you my card. It's got my home number on it. I want to buy the first pair when the next shipment comes in.
All right,
Jimmy, good talking to you. Here you go.
Jimmy will see you around.
Yeah. This will probably cost Jimmy $10 million. That's how that's... That's life with the 1%.
Don't you understand how important this golf tournament was to Jimmy? Thank you, Dr. John. Toaster to David. I was thinking of the same reference. Oh, thanks, David and Maine, for reminding me. Yeah, there's a new song out from Hank Williams Jr., Bo Cephas, hating on Obama. I saw a right-wing blast email about that not long back. Oh, well. Apparently, the number of volunteers to save the Checkered Pants golf tournament was vastly inflated by the right-winger over in Beckley. Jim noting that he claimed the number of volunteers was over 1,000. Coming out to save the golf tournament! Jeeves. Never a dull moment. They just can't resist rubbing... and it doesn't matter if you're in West Virginia or any other place. The 1% cannot resist the essential impulse to rub our noses in it. Now... Andy Borowitz, the satirist, had a piece about Willard Romney addressing the National Association for the Advancement of Rich White People in the Cayman Islands. That was not real. It is, however, real that Willard Romney addressed the NAACP in Houston, as noted. Houston? Where he was booed for talking about how he would repeal Obamacare. In point of fact, after being booed in Houston, he gave another speech entirely in Montana. He got on his plane in Houston and flew to Montana in the same day. It can happen, especially if you're Willard. He asserted that wanting access to affordable health care is the same as wanting free stuff. By the way, I had the privilege of speaking today at the NAACP convention in Houston, and I gave them the same speech I am giving you. I don't give different speeches to different audiences, all right. I gave them the same speech. When I mentioned I am going to get rid of Obamacare, they weren't happy. I didn't get the same response. That's okay. I want people to know what I stand for, and if I don't stand for what they want, go vote for someone else. That's just fine. But I hope people understand this. Your friends who like Obamacare, you remind them of this. If they want more stuff from government, tell them to go vote for the other guy. More free stuff. But don't forget, nothing is really free. It has to be paid for by people in the private sector, creating goods and services, and if people want jobs more than they want free stuff from government, then they are going to have to get government to be smaller. And if they don't want to repeal Obamacare, they are going to have to give me some other stuff they are thinking about cutting, but my list takes Obamacare off first, and I have a lot of other things I am thinking of cutting.
BYU education just didn't go far in the whole reasoning department, did it? Don't forget, nothing is really free. It has to be paid for by people in the private sector creating goods and services. And if people want jobs more than they want free stuff from government, then they are going to have to get government to be smaller. That whole deductive reasoning class was just a waste out there. But maybe they don't offer it at BYU. Maybe everything there, maybe the whole degree program is predicated on crap you read through rocks in a via rocks through a hat on golden plates that you can't find. But they can't resist rubbing our noses in it. It's just that it's too much. Free stuff. Wanting to be able to take your child to the doctor and not be driven from your home as a result of crushing debt is the same thing to a member of the 1% as wanting free stuff. Wanting to be able to live another 10 years after open-heart bypass surgery so that your grandchildren can know you and remember you. You know, family values. That is a matter, in Willard Romney's world, of wanting free stuff. Is freedom free stuff? And it's not like this is something that is accidental. It's not like this is a policy that is unique to Willard Romney. Oh no. No, no, no. It is, in large part, unique to the Repiglican Party. It is certainly unique to the teabaggers. Get your government hands off my Medicare! No, for Willard Romney, access to medical care is a desire for free stuff. Access to education is free stuff. And as the House of Representatives have proven, wanting access to food is just more freeloading by the 99%. That proof comes to us today via the House Agriculture Committee, who approved the 2012 Farm Bill, the Farm Bill is actually more like the Farm Cuts. Because while there probably is some pork and some fat inside the Farm Bill, you know, corporate welfare for the Monsantos and Archer Daniels Midlands and ConAgras of the world, the Farm Bill also cuts $35 billion from the federal food and nutrition budget. Of that $35 billion cut out of it, $16.5 billion of the cuts, almost half, are cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, which is commonly referred to as food stamps. Somewhat less commonly referred to as simply welfare. Those $16.5 billion of cuts happen by doing something on the order of between 2 and 3 million Americans out of access to food stamps and throwing 280,000 children off of automatic enrollment in free lunch at school. Why? Because the 1% don't have enough yet. Because, in point of fact, they want it all. They literally want the little bit of food that 280,000 children eat at school. They want people's food. Is the profundity of their avarice plain enough to see yet? They want the food out of children's mouths. That's not hyperbole. That is not exaggeration. It's not stretching the truth. The Republican Party confirmed today via action of the House Agriculture Committee that it literally wants the food out of children's mouths. Some of those children will be lower income children of lower income parents who will go into voting booths in states like South Carolina stan and Georgia stan and Florida stan and Mississippi stan and Alabama stan, and they'll vote for them a Republican because he's got family values and he's conservative. Mommy, how come I can't eat lunch at school? Because we don't want, honey lamb, because we don't want you being dependent on the government. Flush Flemballe, I'm sure, would say that they merely need to learn to dumpster dive. That was his response a few months ago, was it not? Jesus Christ. And if you bring up stories to the Repiglickans and the teabaggers about the realities of this hateful behavior, they say they don't want to hear no sob stories. Really, sob stories. That's what they call it. That's a candidate for the United States Senate in Wisconsin, a Republican, of course, Eric Hovde, H-O-V-D-E. I'd like to buy a Y, Alex, so that I can, Pat, somebody, and figure out how to pronounce this. Eric Hovde said he's fed up, this was about a month ago, fed up with sad personal stories about Americans who've been affected by the Great Recession. I don't know. Do you file this under at least he's honest?
That's the end of my spiel. Sorry for taking too long getting here. I hope I didn't go over long with my speech. But it was a great pleasure being here with you today. It's great seeing Leah. Rich, Robin, a lot of friends.
Yeah, okay, sure. And this is the end of his spiel, as he says, but yet it goes on for about 15 minutes. I don't know, that word, end, I don't think it means what he thinks it means. But that's okay. We'll just, we'll pick up, let's pick up here.
He's for 21 years. I've had multiple sclerosis, and unfortunately, you know, I've done well. So very few things ever have scared me ever in my life, as my older daughter can tell you. This issue really scares me. Because it will, and we're not just talking our kids and our grandkids. It'll come in the next 4 or 5 years if we don't change course. I mean, we've got to do it like right now. So I see a reporter here. I just pray that you start writing about these issues. I just pray, stop always writing about, the person couldn't get, their food stamps or this or that. I saw something the other day. It just, it's like another sob story, and I'm like, but what about what's happening to the country and the country as a whole? That's going to devastate everybody.
You know, I've got a news flash for this freak. The people are the country. The country is the people. They are one and the same. Sweet Jesus. And somewhere along the way, somebody has to bring Jesus up. No, it's not Wednesday or anything, but the only time he really commented on tax rates or tax was when he said, you got to pay your taxes, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and unto God that which is God's. That's a rather poetic way of saying, pay your taxes, you damn deadbeats. But he said a whole lot about how you treat the people with those sob stories. Feed the hungry. Clothe the naked. House the homeless. Visit those sick and in prison. Provide comfort. Not platitudes about the need to cut taxes. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Right? You'd think this would be easy for people who are constantly flogging their Bible. But it's lost on them. Totally freaking lost on them. And it amazes me. Dr. John noting free stuff, huh? Let me get this straight. Giveaways to the 1% don't count as free stuff? No, that's a delivery. That's not free stuff. That's freedom. Also says Dr. John, the Congressional Budget Office reported today that federal taxes and spending were lower last year than the year before Obama took office. So, they're 100% wrong. Bingo. So that's where we find ourselves at the close of this evening's filibobster. I would much prefer to open the phone lines to the rest of you. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Chime in with your thoughts on this thorn in the side Thursday. Your thoughts are welcome via phone, via email, and via your participation in the chat room. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. Registration is free and easy, and it's a fun little place to hang out during the program. It is Thursday, the 12th of July. That means the Green News Report is on its way. I haven't heard from Brad and Desi in a long time, so I am naturally looking forward to this. This is America's listener-supported, emphasis on listener-supported. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, as is the snail mail address, Liberal Voice. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. We'll be back.
I'm free.
Preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, July 12, 2012.
A new report and a major alert about the speed of climate change on this planet.
Corporate media finally covers climate change.
Climate change is loading the dice, kind of like a baseball player on steroids, greater capability of breaking records.
Global warming making intense heat waves more likely. The climate change denial industry now going after science journalists Plus,
the Harper government is the most right-wing government we've ever had in this country. I don't think they care about the environment.
Mad scientists in Canada are revolting.
All of that climate change and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Time after time after time, green energy has proved to be unworthy. Therefore, the president finds himself on the wrong side of history.
And no one knows the wrong side of history like you, Bill O'Reilly. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, great news. All of the network news outfits are now covering climate change. Does that mean we get to quit the Green News Report?
Oh, no, not hardly. I mean, it's, I know it's something that we rarely say. Good job, corporate media. They really did a nice job connecting extreme weather with climate change science. Here's ABC.
Hundreds of scientists from around the globe saying today there is evidence that global warming is accelerating.
CBS.
NOAA made a point of saying today that the climate change they've identified as man-made.
And NBC.
The word tonight from federal government weather experts, get used to it.
They all covered the record heat wave in the context of a new report that confirms the influence of human-caused global warming in specific extreme weather disasters around the world in 2011, which was a record year. A new report issued this week from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration warns that while not all events could be tied to global warming, human-caused global warming is like weather on steroids, so these events are more likely, more frequent, and more intense, and will increase, as the director for the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Thomas Carl, explained to NBC.
The additional increase in intensity and frequency is caused, not in every case, but in many cases, by human activity increasing greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere.
Not surprisingly, the climate change denial industry is stepping up its efforts with a new tactic to intimidate climate scientists. Records uncovered by The Guardian show a climate denial think tank called the American Tradition Institute is using Freedom of Information Act requests to obtain the emails of science journalists and their correspondence with climate scientists who receive federal research funding.
Oh, good. They'll uncover the conspiracy any second.
Oh, any minute now. It's an attempt to discredit those journalists as activists, they say. The New York Times and other targeted outlets say they stand by their reporting. Meanwhile,
overfishing, nutrient and chemical pollution, habitat alteration and invasive species, now climate change and ocean acidification.
The world's coral reefs are seriously being stressed out by climate change and other human impacts, say scientists at the International Coral Reef Symposium underway right now in Cairns, Australia this week. New research shows that the combined changes in ocean temperature and ocean chemistry now being observed have not occurred since a major coral reef die-off 55 million years ago. Reducing emissions is critical to reversing ocean acidification and saving the marine food web, they say, along with reducing agricultural runoff. Industrialized overfishing, it's a daunting but doable task, says NOAA Administrator and marine ecologist Jane Lubchenco.
Okay, so you said this happened 55 million years ago. Doesn't this prove that climate change, global warming, ocean acidification is just cyclical? It happens every now and again, every few million years.
Well, of course, climate has always changed in the past. What matters is what's driving the change. Right now, it's human activities loading the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, and scientists say, additionally, it's the speed of change. Rather than over millennia, it's over decades.
Oh, yeah, well, there's that.
Finally, in Canada,
no fire, no evidence, no truth.
Mad scientists are revolting.
They certainly are.
Canada's conservative Harper administration is borrowing a page from the Bush administration playbook, cutting science research and suppressing data. That's the charge from several hundred scientists who marched in protest on Parliament Hill in Ottawa this week in a mock funeral procession behind a coffin and a costumed Grim Reaper protesting what they called, quote, the death of evidence, with sweeping cuts to scientific research, shuttering research facilities, and eliminating entire regulatory offices.
My general message to the crowd here and Canadians in general is that good decisions depend on evidence, all the evidence being brought forward and considered and weighed.
Oh, you scientists and your evidence.
Oh, I know, causing all that trouble for the poor. fossil fuel industry.
Indeed. For more on that and all of the other stories we couldn't get to today, please check out our website, greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. While ABC, NBC, and CBS did some decent reporting this week, they probably won't next week. So you're still going to need us, and we're still going to need you to keep telling the truth over your public airwaves. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Eleven past the hour, I'm Bob, this is The Horn. Back behind the microphone after the misery of the big-ass storm. That's the Idiocracy term for derecho. Extra big ass storm. Yeah. Jump on into the conversation. I filibustered on your nickel last night. Light him up if you want to. Marty asking, just out of idle curiosity, who won the golf tournament? Don't know. Couldn't look. Marty also added, you're about to make me go off and listen to the last track of George Carlin's last recorded show. They want people's food? Who was the so-called reverend who said, starve! I don't care! And that was corpulent Reverend John Hagee of course, Texas. Marty says, so of course the Republicans voted to snatch food out of kids' mouths. Yeah, of course. William with an early one-liner for the evening. Mitt's speech was a crock of Mitt. He'll be here for the rest of the week. Don't forget to tip your waitress. Try the veal. Golf. And you know what? I got another golf story. Thorn in the side. I got another golf story. But by all means, hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Trying to get back to some semblance of normal.
I'm sure you had quite an ordeal up there.
It was no fun. How long did it take before you got power back?
Power went off here at 8 o'clock and came back on at 3:30 the next afternoon, thankfully.
Oh, wow.
But Friday night was a bit of a sticky wicket because the cell phone went out. And, you know, I hadn't thought to charge it because this thing just came up on us so quickly.
Yeah.
And it was just like the end of the world. It really was.
Yeah, I've had people writing and say, you know, was it really that weird? And, yeah, it was. It was never, ever seen anything like it.
I don't know why they call this thing La Derecha. I'm sure that the Republicans would probably call it La Izquierda, which is Spanish for the left, you know?
Yeah.
Let's say the leftist aggravated the forces of nature into delivering this.
Well, remember, they tend to blame the gay community for earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes, right?
Yeah.
9/11?
Just like they did in Constantinople back in the, 9th century or whenever.
Right.
The buggery, all these natural disasters. And my God, well, I guess it must have been all that buggery going on in some of those monasteries. Who knows?
Yeah, look, it just goes to prove that the Republican Party is offering the very best in 9th century thinking, Jim.
Well, Bob, I don't even know if it's that, because basically what I think they want is return to feudalism.
True. True.
Yeah, I mean, certain. And as far as free, the only free they want is maybe to see Ann Margaret come out of a TV set on a bunch of soap bubbles, like in Tommy. I believe that was from Tommy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Oh, good memory.
Yeah, Lord. Yeah, 1975, I think. But, you know, it's just incredible. As far as family values and concern for people, these people, these assholes wouldn't know those values if it hit them in the ass.
No, they wouldn't.
You know, as far as flogging their Bibles are concerned, I think they're flogging something else. I mentioned it on the air.
Right. No, just wait. You know, wait for the next news cycle. Some Republican doing something god-awful in a bathroom is bound to pop up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know. Well, that's what they do anyway when they get on the air. They may, you know, flogging their tongue or flogging their willy, whatever. You know, it's just... And, I mean, when you see people like Reverend Hagee, who I don't think has missed a meal in, 30,000 years, or Chris Christie up in New Jersey.
And don't forget Governor LePage in Maine. No, none of these guys have been pushing back from the dinner table peremptorily.
No, they haven't. And yet they want to, you know, they have no sensitivity to programs that will provide free school lunches and also to, and they want to cut food stamps in half and things of that nature. I mean, I don't know where these guys get their feelings from, I think I can answer that. They just don't have any. I don't think they have any conscience. I don't think they have any sense of right or wrong. They're totally amoral, and they're totally insensitive, and what other words can I use? They are just, to me, they are...
Sociopathic?
Sociopathy is definitely a part of the program. I mean, I don't think they're really capable of any type of having a conscience. I believe all of them could take a lie detector test and pass it and lie like crazy when they did so, because basically that's what a lie detector fails to, detect are people who are basic sociopaths. And if you were to subject these idiots to any type of truth detection or whatever, I don't give a damn if you gave them scopolamine or sodium pentothal. They're so wired up inside, they could pass it.
Right, because the that fundamental part of the human brain that differentiates between falsehood and factual truthfulness is utterly missing in them.
Well, these people have no souls. And in the eyes of the fundamentalist Christians, they have committed the unpardonable sin. That's what they've done.
Well, if they followed their own the tenets of their own beliefs, but as usual, Jim, those are applied to us and not to them.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, they simply are taking their version of honesty and truth as portrayed in the Bible or whatever, or the good things that Christ said, and they're basically using it as a weapon.
Yeah, absolutely.
And these guys are buying it too. These poor ignorant people who wouldn't know what the founding fathers were. I mean, they had this thing recently when they quizzed a bunch of high school students about the founding fathers. And these kids didn't know. And the lack of education and, you know, devotion to history and stuff like that, and the teaching of history for the past 30 years has been so attenuated that we have reared a generation of ignoramuses, of vipers. I mean, initially they're an ignoramus, and then when they buy into this stuff and support it, that's when they become a viper. You know, Philip Wiley wrote a book back in the 50s called A Generation of Vipers, and he pointed all this out about the same time that Silent Spring came out by Rachel Carson. You ought to pick it up, Philip Wiley, A Generation of Vipers.
Spell that last. Let me write this down.
I believe it's Philip with, I'm not sure if it's one or two L's, but W-Y-L-I-E.
I got it right here. I'll go have a look.
Yeah, take a look at that.
Well, it's amazing. A lot of this stuff is out, has been out there for a while. John Dean, a few years back, wrote Conscience of a Conservative. And he relied a lot on statistical research and psychometric and psychological research that had been done on authoritarians in years past. It has been there. We know what is, we know what's going on, but it is almost as though, Jim, we are powerless to stop it.
It would appear so. And it would appear that you know, lack of power and lack of ability to stop it is growing less and less every day.
And I think that is by design.
Oh, yeah. They've been planning this stuff for 20 or 30 years, and it started off...
No, it's like the conversation I had with John Fox last night after the program, trying to get him to understand that the Confederacy is in full flower right now. They, you know, they lost the physical martial conflict, but in the long run, they have prevailed, especially in places like you and I come from.
Well, you know, Bob, I'll tell you one thing. I even think the people who lived back then in the Confederacy probably, by comparison, would be more compassionate than the people who are living today, to tell you the truth. Because there is no code of honor among these people. For them, honor changes daily. Just like Mr. Romney's Etch-a-Sketch, you know, philosophy and what he says one day next. I mean, he just says anything he wants to please whoever he's talking to.
Right, yeah, he's straight out of that letter from St. Paul where he said, "Lo, I was all things to all people."
Right.
But he's no St. Paul. And as a consequence, one hopes it'll catch up with him, but I don't know if it will. You know, right now...
doesn't look that way, does it?
No, and it's becoming frightening. You know, as our good friend Malloy noted a few weeks back, just, you know, let that roll off your tongue a couple of times. President Romney. Imagine saying that for 4 or 8 years. President Romney.
Or and Vice just, President Rubio.
Or, hey, how about Vice President kind of sleazy Rice? You know, that was one of the big speculations of the last week.
Is she being vetted?
It's my understanding. That's what I got from what I read. And now the blast emails are trying to create some buzz around the choice of vice president. For some reason or another, I'm on Willard Romney's email list. Bob, we're getting ready to share some exciting news sometime between now and the Republican convention. Mitt will be announcing his choice for VP. Know what's even more exciting? Every week until the VP announcement is made, one lucky supporter will win the chance to meet Mitt and his choice for VP. Can you give $3 today to be automatically entered for the chance to meet Mitt and his choice for VP in person? I wouldn't give 3 cents, Jim.
Will Bachelorette number 1 please come out from behind the curtain?
You know, or the closet.
I was going to let you say that. I was, but I'm... I thought Condoleezza was content to be back in California at, where, is Palo Alto, isn't that where she lives?
Yeah, I think so. You know, that kind of power is an aphrodisiac, I suppose. My big question is, if she were made vice president, would she accidentally refer to Willard as my husband, like she did... dim leader.
Oh, God, I remember that.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. I don't know. I'll tell you.
And, you know, I mean, because, among other things, remember, kind of Sleazy Rice has Deep South roots. Her parents were farmers, sharecroppers, I think, in Alabama.
Yeah, they were. Absolutely.
So that, you know, there would be some sense to that, because with this splinter movement out there telling Republicans and Democrats alike to write in Jesus Christ for President of the United States, they have to be concerned. Because there's still a significant portion of the Republican base that thinks that Willard Romney is a member of a cult. Just like the Moonies. You know, when they say the cult, they mean, when they say cult, they mean Moonies, Krishna, you know, all of the Branch Davidians, Jim Jones, and the right wing holds Mormonism in that same light.
Well, you know, I've never understood the Book of Mormon. I remember when I was in a hotel, it was a Marriott hotel, and I think that family are Mormons. And instead of Gideon Bibles, they had the Book of Mormon in there. And I picked it up one night when I was, TDY, away from home in the hotel. And I thought to myself, what am I reading here? I thought to myself, good Lord, my mother used to read fairy tales to me.
It's like what would happen if Ayn Rand had written something in the 19th century instead of the 20th. If you understand, and I know you do, you know your history and everything. If you understand the dynamic of the American experience, say from around 1825 to say 1850,
mm-hmm.
in addition to all the back and forth over issues of slavery and secession and the major issues, there was also that thing called the Awakening. And there was all kinds of wild, bizarre speculation about the native peoples who it turned out were here when this vast uncharted wilderness was allegedly discovered.
You mean the lost tribes of Israel?
And that's part of it. Yes, yeah. The lost tribes of Israel hokum preceded the Willard Romney's religion by decades. So you have to kind of take that into account, but you know the seeing stones and all of that other bunko that goes into the origins of Mormonism,
may I ask you one thing?
Yeah.
What are the seeing stones?
Oh dear.
That's okay.
Oh okay. No. It's just every time you try to tell somebody this, they say, no, not really, Bob. Yes, really. This is true. Joseph Smith, who had been involved before inventing Mormonism, he'd been involved in several bunko schemes. I think maybe one of them involved searching for gold, you know, and of course the plates were of gold. So the angel Moron, because this is all a big practical joke that Joseph Smith got caught up in, and then decided, hey, I can run with this.
Yeah, it's a good hustle.
Yeah, yeah. Never walk away from a good dodge. So he tells the angel Moron or Moroni, moronic.
Right.
Okay.
I got it.
It's a big practical joke. Appears to him and tells him that there are these plates with the history of a lost tribe of the children of Israel, and he tells him where to go and dig and find them. And this is in upstate New York, somewhere. Dr. John may be able to fill in the blanks here. Maybe somewhere near Elmira.
Yeah. So they were golden plates or something like
that. Yeah. So they're buried in the ground, and he digs them up. But it's written in. Oh dear God. They're allegedly written in Middle Egyptian or some permutation of Egyptian that never even existed, you know, because we've got linguists. No, there's no such language. So they're written in Egyptian, Old Egyptian, Middle Egyptian, Proto-Egyptian, Linear Egyptian. I don't know.
Well, those things don't exist.
No.
The Egyptians had hieroglyphs. And then they had a short form called Hieratic.
Right. That Coptic script. Right. So the angel Moron tells him to where to find the plates. He digs up the plates. He can't read the plates. And the angel Moron then tells him, look, I've got these here rocks. And if you'll put the rocks in your hat, They will translate the plates, and then you can dictate the translation into English.
By putting rocks in his hat.
Yes. See? See, I get the same response every time, Jim. But see, that's another thing. Seeing stones were another hustle that was out there. He didn't invent seeing stones. Just like, you've traveled US 60 over here on this side of the New River, haven't you, Jim?
Unfortunately.
Now.
Well,
it ain't much, but we call it home.
I know.
Okay, so as you get off of US 19 and
no offense intended.
I understand. As you get off 19 and you go west on 60, there's a beautiful hilltop pasturage, meadow, whatever, and you'll see these lines of beautiful dressed stone walls.
Okay.
And they really are, they're eye-catching and quite captivating.
Right.
Well, those walls were built by a sect of, a breakaway sect of Seventh-day Adventists. And they were literally on the Midland Trail. Like I said, US 60 is a trail that was here a long time before the white folks got here. It started out as a deer path. But anyway, they're traveling in their wagon, and they're spiritualists. And they've got a seance table in the wagon, and the table begins to knock when they get to that place. And the knocking on the table tells them that that is where they should stop and settle and form their commune, because like many breakaway sects, they had a utopian bent. And so they were the ones who built those stone walls. Because in that period from about 1825 to 1850, there were all kinds of folks wandering all over the country with all of these spiritualist notions that involved knocking on tables, looking through rocks in hats, and trying to find the lost tribes of the children of Israel. And so what Joseph Smith did is he took all of these bunko acts and he distilled them through a little admixture of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam into a sort of Scientology for the 19th century.
Wow, what a spiritual alchemist he must have been.
Absolutely, and he had, you know, he had the one thing that must lie at the heart of anybody seeking to build a religious cult, and I use this in the anthropological sense, not in the, like, you know, Reverend Moon sense. All religions begin as personal cults, and that is a larcenous heart. And so the next thing you know, he tells a couple of people about his, and so then. He begins dictating the Book of Mormon, and he tells other people about it, and there is a predisposition in this country at the time to buy into this kind of bunko. And he starts getting followers, and they start getting power. And the established religious traditions begin to feel very, very threatened by them. So they go from New York to Illinois, what is it? Nauvoo, Illinois. Yeah, Dr. John is telling me the Second Great Awakening. The first was colonial era, Cotton Mather times, and the Second Great Awakening had roots in upstate New York. It was referred to as the Burned Over District because every religious revival in the first two centuries of this country found followers here. The fire of old-time religion was burning hot up here, and Joseph Smith's revelation was in a place called Palmyra.
Right.
Near Rochester.
Yeah, that whole thing was what started out with. It was the guy who did the Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, Jonathan Edwards.
Jonathan Edwards.
And then, of course, it moved into the Great Awakening and these revivals and stuff like that were just...
Yeah, distant relations of Agnes's, by the way, Jonathan Edwards.
Oh, well, congratulations to Agnes. But I mean, the scenes of these revivals, I don't know if you've ever read any of this descriptions of them are staggering beyond belief.
Yes, they are. I mean, they are exercises in ecstatic madness.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I even thought about this. Yeah, I tell you the truth, I tried not to think about it. But I mean, my first exposure to it was in college in a course called Social and Intellectual History of the United States, and they covered that greatly at my alma mater. And nonetheless, even then, when I was pretty young and impressionable, I thought to myself, how can anybody subscribe to this insanity? I mean, what was the driving force in their minds that created it? I mean, I've never quite been able to understand all this fundamentalism and stuff like that. I've just never.
Well, you've got to you have to, as with everything, Jim, you have to take things in context. And the context of the country at that time was a frontier that was being settled by people who were barely, if literate at all, who were easily swayed and could only be swayed by appeals not to intellect but to emotions. So all of the cool Apollonian reason that had attended the Enlightenment and the founding of this country was gone. It was gone by the second decade of the 19th century. I mean, just gone. You begin to see intimations of it when Madison, in what is it, Federalist 10, begins to say, okay, it looks like we're going to have faction after all, and it'll be okay as long as everybody's looking after their common interests.
Right.
And by the second decade of the 19th century, any pretense of intellect is gone. It has always struck me as being a sublime satire, or perhaps outright sarcasm, that this religious frenzy that struck the United States in the period we're talking about, the Second Great Awakening, is referred to as a Great Awakening, because actually it's a great hypnosis. It's a great going to sleep. It's a great walking away from reason.
Well, Bob, it's predatory. That's the thing about it. It's so dangerous.
Well, it was also handy. It was of course expressly a Protestant thing, and it was used to foment hatred of Roman Catholics and hatred for Catholic immigrants coming to this country, whether they were German, Italian, or Irish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know...
And it was, as is often the case with almost all religions, a means, first and foremost, not of balming the suffering soul or soothing the aching humanity. It was a means of social manipulation and social control.
And social inflammatory.
Well, as long as you can whip them into a frenzy anytime you want to, you've got ready-made revolution, literally on your own frontier. I mean, consider, and some of this maybe predates it, but consider the circumstances around Aaron Burr's adventure down the Mississippi, Ohio, and Mississippi rivers. You know, he was allegedly going to try to foment some sort of revolution that would eventually take Texas away from Mexico and set up an independent republic. I mean, that's the origin of so-called Texas independence. Not Sam Houston, not
right.
David Crockett,
right.
But of Aaron Burr. And what happened is the pressure and the ideas that Aaron Burr raised wind up creating a situation where the United States government had to, and the American people did that preemptive thing and wound up in a war with Santa Anna. Because if they hadn't, it would have happened anyway.
Oh yeah, it resulted in the storming of Chapultepec and, you know, the Great Mexican War and all that stuff. And as I pointed out to you, strangely enough, these people who were in the Alamo that's been so lionized in history, when you look at what really happened, I understand inside the Alamo there were people who were shot by their own people and not the Mexican army.
Yeah.
I mean, they had lied because...
And, of course, it's understood now that David Crockett did not die in the fighting.
No.
He was captured. He begged for his life in front of Santa Ana, and Santa Ana had him killed.
Well, I think if I'd been Santa Ana, I'd probably have said okay, too.
I mean, these were insurrectionists. They were,
yes, they were.
Remember, and I think this is kind of important in the larger conversation, they were people committing treason against Mexico because they were Mexican citizens.
Exactly.
And so, Santa Ana dealt with treasonous people the way that most countries deal with treasonous people. And that is why you and I might disagree on this. That's why as I traveled through the depths of the Old South in Selma and saw all the memorializations of all of those officers who turned on their own country, I can't get away from the fact that it was treason, Jim. It was treason. If a United States military officer today said, I'm going to surrender my commission and engage in warfare against the United States of America, How would we treat that? What would we say about that? Wouldn't it be treason?
Well, Bob, different ages, I think, in different situations define treason, because it was Lincoln who basically did not want to have Lee strung up.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, Lincoln was a very forgiving a very complex man, but
well, and of course, by the time
you say, with malice toward none,
right? And by the time Jefferson Davis went on the run, of course, Lincoln was dead, and his successor, Andrew Johnson, said he was terrified of the idea of putting Jefferson Davis on trial for fear of making a martyr of him. But of course, they had no problem whatsoever putting the noose around Mary Surratt's neck. I don't know if you've seen that film, but it is brilliantly done. The story of Mary Surratt. Robin Wright plays Mary Surratt. Kevin Kline is in it. God, I can't remember the name of it, but it surrounds the trial of Mary Surratt and the horrible constitutional abuses that attended it.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, there were no constitutional rights for these people, none whatsoever. I mean, there was a military...
And that's my point. There were no constitutional rights for them. However, at the end of the day, in the final analysis, the bigwigs who had led the treason against the United States were treated as the rich routinely treat their brother rich.
Well...
I mean, like
Ulysses S. Grant, he didn't want to see Lincoln strung up.
Or Lee, you mean?
No, he did not want to see Lincoln. I mean, Robert E. Lee strung up. No, he did not. And I guess there was a code of honor or something like that among gentlemen. When you've got your opponent down on the mat, you don't crush his neck, but you let him back up. I mean, that was the spirit of Lincoln, and that was the spirit of people like Grant. I mean, to be magnanimous in victory.
But oddly enough, that magnanimity did not extend to the poor.
Well, no. It very seldom does.
No, you're absolutely right. It very seldom does.
Like so many other things that are supposed to trickle down to the poor, I'm afraid it just doesn't quite get there, does it?
No, it doesn't. And, I was so surprised. I had no idea, Jim, that Nathan Bedford Forrest is buried in Selma, Alabama.
Well, I think he started the Klan, and then he realized the excesses of it, and then distanced himself from it, didn't he?
No, it faded. It started out as a terrorist response to Reconstruction, and then the federal government backed away and more or less gave up on Reconstruction by the mid to late 1870s, if not earlier.
1876, basically, is when with Rutherford B. Hayes, when they started. Withdraw troops from the South,
and then the Klan, having served its purpose, went into somewhat of a remission, never fully gone, and then resurges and reblossoms in the early parts of the 20th century and spreads all over the country.
Oh, yeah, and they had the leader of the Klan who had that woman that he raped and killed. Well, her name was Madge Oberholzer or something like that. Remember that story?
Yeah.
It happened in Indiana?
Right, and that's how you wind up with the Klan in Indiana. And that's it's a sad and sorry commentary on our entire, it's a blight on our national character, among other things.
Yeah, sure.
But it was fascinating to me to be in Selma. And, of course, you're familiar with what happened at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It was fascinating to me to walk over that bridge and see the reward poster for Nathan Bedford Forrest's bust prominently placed and deliberately placed, staring down at the Voting Rights Museum and the Bloody Sunday Memorial. That was not an accident.
Oh, I'm sure not. Well, my friend, it has been an interesting conversation. I haven't contributed that whole lot, but anyway.
No, it has been an interesting conversation, and I appreciate it, Jim. It's awfully good to be good to be back on the air and back in touch.
Well, I know you are, because I mean, you were basically isolated back there. I mean, may I ask one thing? Did you have a generator or anything to?
Yeah, well, that's what happened after the first couple of days of trying to get the old one going. We were absolutely blessed by a lot of people who helped us out in getting one, and that's how I wound up driving to Lewisburg to find one. And we got a generator going, but not after all the food was rotten, spoiled, and gone.
Right.
All the perishables, that is. But yeah, we had a generator going, and we were able to, you know, have a few electric lights and get the refrigerator back on, and that's when we discovered the leak that led to my query over engineering design choices. I'm baffled. Haven't heard anything from the engineering and design guys yet, but maybe I'd love to know that there's a perfectly good reason, Jim, for having a quarter-inch line coming in and a 5/16-inch line going out.
Well, Bob, have you thought of this? Have you thought of taking that? They have this stuff, this transparent crazy glue that you will glue anything together, and it's waterproof.
Yeah, but is it fit for human consumption? Because this is a water line.
Yeah. It's totally inert, as far as I know. I mean, you know, the stuff, once it hardens, it's basically like concrete. If you don't believe that, get some on your hand.
Yeah, I'll take a pass on that. It's happened in the past.
I mean, really, I mean, if you have that type of fitting going into a larger or a smaller type fitting, you need to seal it, right?
Well, actually, the water chiller unit is what has the leak in it. If I could fix the leak, it's a little pinhole leak that seems to just, I mean, it looks like a pinhole leak, but it winds up being something that can fill a 5-gallon bucket in almost no time flat.
Well, it's more than a pinhole leak. You know, that's just basic hydraulics. And so, I don't know. I don't know if you can. I don't know what to. Well, you have somebody who's already suggested that you go to a website where you can find solutions.
And I found a little coupler, and it was weird. They actually have the 1/4 to 5/16 coupler, Jim. These little couplings, it's called a union in some places.
Yeah.
Although not in the South, I'm sure.
No, it's called a union. That's what plumbers call it when you have to join two different size pipes.
And so these things were like $2.50 a piece in Lowe's yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Online, it's $18.10 plus shipping.
Oh, well, that doesn't surprise me at all.
no, but it does take one's breath away.
Yeah, it does. Well, I'm glad that you survived all this. It was really pretty bad, and you know, as far as the references to the Greenbrier and all that, I mean, you've already explained that pretty well, and it shows you where people's priorities are, and those people who are behind them.
Well, it certainly shows that sense of noblesse oblige does not obtain within the ranks of the nouveau riche coal baron.
Bob, it never existed.
Okay. I'll take your honesty.
It never existed with these people, because that's how they got to be where they are.
Merciless predators.
merciless predators. Exactly right. They never had any sense of conscience or whatever, and there's no sense of compassion for their fellow human beings. All they wanted to do was, if I hear me now, and hooray for me, and to hell with you. That's the whole spirit of it. That's the way I interpret it.
Jim, did you ever get around to watching Idiocracy? I know it's not your usual fare, but did you?
No, I haven't.
You owe yourself that. It is madcap, wacky, social commentary comedy. But you just reminded me of, there's a bad word involved, but there's a scene where the machine, where the Carl's Jr. hamburger food machine says, "Carl's Jr., F you, I'm eating." And, you know, that's what we're dealing with here. Screw you, I'm having a golf tournament.
Yeah. And of course, these people have been lionized for having done so. And like I told you in email, instead of 400, supposedly there were over 1,000 who were clearing the fairways and stuff like that, or the greenways, or whatever you want to call it. And basically, while other people less than 2 miles away, octogenarian grandmothers who were suffering. I mean, you know, it's just incredible. I'm sure I wouldn't have had power either had I not lived so close to, you know, the motels and things like that that they were going to use for overfill.
Exactly. Yeah. They got services to where the Greenbrier needed services.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And there are, I should note, in this state still people who do not have electricity.
Yeah, I know. I want to ask you one thing. Do they ever use that bunker up there for anything? I'm not trying to prolong this conversation.
No. I mean,
it was called Operation Greek Island. And, of course, it came in at like 60 or 62. I think right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that's when they constructed this huge bunker with these big blast doors and all this stuff. And then back in the early 90s, the Washington Post exposed it. And they said, well, oops, there it goes. So I wonder where they are now.
Well, apparently when Jim Justice bought the Greenbrier, by his remarks in that news story that Juanita sent along, it came with the bunker included.
Yeah,
and it came with all the accoutrement of the bunker, you know, not the least of which was all the generators and backup and water pumps. And
yeah, have you seen a documentary on that thing?
Oh, yeah. You know, a long time ago, I had this great idea. I wanted to rent the bunker and do a screening, you know, for some charity. Yeah, pick one. I wanted to rent the bunker and do a screening of Dr. Strangelove. And
learned to love the bomb.
Yeah, Dr. Strangelove and On the Beach and Failsafe in a sort of little mini movie festival.
Boy, that would have been a visual trilogy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't it? In the bunker, no less.
My God, I don't know what these people were thinking. And that bunker, if it even took a direct hit, would, let's face it. You know, I know, you know. It wouldn't have lasted 2 seconds.
No, but the irony of, and that's the thing, the way you'd line
I
it
mean,
up,
you'd show
Failsafe, then you'd show On the Beach, and then you'd show, as the final film, you'd show Dr. Strangelove, and of course that scene of George C. Scott screaming, "We cannot have a mine shaft gap!"
No. And, you know, here's another thing. They've evacuated Cheyenne Mountain.
Wow.
Because guess what?
Not secure.
It don't work. I mean, you know, all that drilling and all that stuff and all that, I don't know what they're going to use it for. I mean, you know, it's a huge complex.
Well, ultimately, the lesson is there is no such thing as a survivable nuclear war.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it basically the doctrine was called mutual assured destruction.
Yeah.
And you know, there would be no way to survive. I mean, you might be able to last what, a couple weeks at most, and then you have to come out.
Well, even something as, I don't want to say prosaic, but expectable within the terms of climate change as this storm was. It really did. I keep saying it, and perhaps I don't elaborate on it enough or explain what it is I mean when I say it. It exposed us, Jim. It completely exposed us. Because nobody does have 2 weeks worth of rice and beans.
Mm-mm. No, they don't.
And if you're on a city water supply and you don't have 50 gallons of potable water sitting somewhere, you know, just waiting, that you periodically replace,
you're SOL.
You are in bad trouble. It doesn't matter if you're on a city sewer or on a septic system. When you can't flush the toilet, you're in trouble. I mean, you got the bone and you're dancing around the monolith at that point, Jim.
Well, sure you are. And, you know, they had this program that was on, I think, Nat Geo or something like that about all these survivalists and the stuff that they're planning and these people devote their lives to building these shelters inside old missile silos and stuff like that. I mean, you know, when you've got bombs that are going to have a half-life of 500 years, I mean, what are they going to do down there? Is it going to be Mask of the Red Death, that type thing? I mean, I just wonder, have you seen any of those?
Subterranean Lord of the Flies, as far as I can tell.
I mean, have you seen any of those programs?
Oh, sure.
I thought to myself, lady, what are you thinking? As far as I'm concerned, the luckiest person in the world would be right at ground zero.
Yeah,
I mean, not to get too.
But no, I mean, we are well and truly and completely exposed.
Oh yeah, this storm proved it. This derecha, I mean, it completely destroyed an infrastructure that was already in bad shape.
Right, and what was our response? And I guess it's the only response you can have, Jim. And I too am not trying to prolong this conversation, but I think this is engaging. What was our response? Our response was to put up new poles where the old poles got blown down. And maybe cut a few trees out of the way because they were desperate to get electricity going again.
Right.
But the real conversation that needs to take place is why we persist, knowing that this is the consequence of having such a system, why we persist in having this system instead of trying to innovate toward a new one. Distributed power grids really work. If I'm using the right terminology. A power grid where everybody is feeding into the grid instead of waiting for some centralized power to feed downstream to them is much less likely to be affected as gravely as we were.
Well, Bob, you know why they're not going to buy off on that, because the centralized grid gives them control, access, billing capability, that type of thing, you know?
Quarterly share dividends?
Exactly. That's the engine driving this train.
And you know, I find it so funny that the right wing is forever inveighing against, you know, central government, centralized planning. You can't plan an economy. You know the script, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And yet here we have the idea of a decentralized power grid. Well, no, we can't have that. That's communism.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's not.
Listen, I go back a long ways to, you know, the old no nukes thing back in the 70s and you know, we were talking about anti-nuclear plants and the thing that you're talking about, the power grid. And basically the argument was against it or, you know, was, well, if we do that, then we can't have it coming from a central point and we can't build these people and take care of our investors and, you know, our financial monoliths.
Right, because at the end of the day, it is more important to take care of the 1% investors than it is to take care of the public utilities. You know, the whole reason that public service commissions came in as functions of state government was so as to keep these power companies from becoming a profiteering nightmare. And yet, lo and behold, the public service commissions are peopled with industry flax, hacks, and cronies, and so they become exactly that. You know, and I know, Jim, that in no time flat, they as soon as everybody's power's back on, yeah, they're going to get back in front of the Public Service Commission and say, oh, that storm cost us a lot, and we're going to have a rate increase.
Well,
how about you just declare that you're not going to pay your CEO $50 million a year, and that you're not going to declare stock dividends for a while, and you just go about the business of providing electricity to the people, which was your original mission, not profiteering. It'll be a telling moment in West Virginia when that rate increase request comes through, and they'll wait until they think we've gone back to sleep, Jim. There needs to be a crowd of 10, 20, 25,000 people surrounding the Public Service Commission the minute, the very instant that Appalachian Power decides to ask for a rate increase.
Well, Bob, this PSC crowd, they're nothing but hacks for the AEP and all
right.
the people. You know that. And I'm going to say one more thing. I'm going to get off here because I know you got people who want to talk to you. I can remember back, you know, when the stock market tanked back in, what, 2007?
Yeah.
And I was talking to my sister, and all I could hear from her was, oh, I'm taking such a beating. Oh, it was just, I mean, I said, well, are you sitting there in sackcloth and ashes? I said, what about the people whose jobs are being impacted? And what about the suffering this caused?
Right.
Funnily enough, we don't talk much. And on that note,
Jim, have a good night, my friend.
I'm going to leave you where I found you.
All right, you take care now.
Where you found me, okay?
All right, bye now.
Bye.
That's our good buddy, Jim. But that's the truth, and it's and please understand, this is not a local show, this is not a regional show, but this is life around here. But guess what? It's life around wherever you are too, because you're largely in the United States. If you live in a civilized country, maybe you've got a more dependable grid. Maybe you don't have people who scream communism at the sight of a wind turbine. Or totalitarianism at the sight of a solar panel. Maybe, just maybe, you're lucky enough to live somewhere like that. But here in the United States of America, it does not matter if you're in Appalachia, the Midwest, the Great Plains, the West Coast, you are here. And you are living on an infrastructure that is more fragile than a spider's web. Far more fragile than a spider's web. And you do not have a 2-week supply of beans and rice. And you do not have 200 gallons of water put away that you periodically replenish. Look at your water bill sometimes. See what your daily usage looks like. See if that doesn't serve as a rather chilling wake-up call. This place where I live used to be much more sustainable than it is now. It had a 2-tiered cistern system, and every gutter on every roof, from the barn to the chicken coop to the outbuildings, to the house itself, led into that 2-tiered, gravity-driven cistern system. And there was almost never a want of water. The people who live here never drank the cistern water. They drank and cooked with water from what was then a magnificent, deeper than anything around here, well. It was crystal clear and ice cold. But since they blew up the mountain out the road 25 years ago, well, it's red. It stinks, and it's toxic. But you don't have a cistern. I don't have a cistern. Most of you don't have a well. I have one. It's useless. I mean, this is not the part of the program where I introduce you to our new sponsor, dryedfood.com. If that was the case, I wouldn't be out here pitching for contributions and asking for your generous and kind support. But I'm simply saying that there needs to be a much more serious discussion about the fragility of our existence and whether or not we are satisfied with that fragility. I mean, we had a generator going here, and things were still getting a little bit dicey. You remember what I said once upon a time about the American people not really rising up till the cable goes off and stays off? That wasn't a joke. It was for real. If you take people who are unwittingly addicted and unaware of how much they rely on just the steady stream of information to keep them engaged in their own existence, although by being so inundated they really aren't, and you cut off that flood stream, and they sit around and start thinking about their existence for real, it gets pretty hateful pretty quick. And it deserves a lot more attention and a lot more discussion than we or anyone else will give it. I mean, I'm sitting here talking about it in the hopes that more will. Because there's a bunch of crazy shit out there that occupies our attention. But at the end of the day, there are three things. Food, water, okay, five things. I don't know how many things. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But food, water, air, shelter. It should actually go air, water, food, shelter. Because you can go about 5 minutes without air. You can go about 3 days without water. You can go about 40 days without food. And technically, you can go even longer without shelter. But when all of those things begin to degrade, they take each other with it. And again, we are not prepared. Let's say for a moment that climate change is the hoax that Jim Inhofe says it is, and so many of his right-wing repig-licking brethren and sistren. Let's say that it is. Just for the sake of argument. In the light most favorable to that argument. It's also fraud. What we experienced here last week was, just in the words of George Will, summer. Because this just happens in summer. The massive storm fronts in straight lines move 700 miles at 70 miles an hour across the middle of the country and knock the snot out of a region that is most unused to being so abused. It's just a coincidence. It just happens. Well, even if viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the deniers, it just happens, we're still not prepared for it. And what's more, we appear to have no inclination whatsoever to get prepared for it. And I recognize that there's a fine line involved in saying, take the necessary precautions and be ready, versus sounding like some hysterical apocalyptic maniac. But 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks worth of rice, 2 weeks worth of beans, 2 weeks worth of cornmeal, a camp stove, 2 weeks worth of propane to run it, 2 weeks worth of water. Where are you going to put it? And I keep saying 2 weeks because if it goes on longer than 2 weeks, odds are party's over and you don't want to hang out for the, you don't want to be the last one out the door. You know, if you've got a generator, gasoline. And that's one of those things that you really can't store because gasoline is of poor quality anymore and it turns to varnish in a damn hurry. This idea of preparedness, I well remember being a graduate student at the University of Alabama, and my work study job was to maintain the, it was in the theater department, and my job was to maintain the properties morgue. You know, if somebody needed a sword, they'd come and check it out for me. My little office was way up in the attic of the theater building, and I just took my own initiative to go in there and start wandering around and inventorying the place. And lo and behold, up in the attic of this old theater building was what at the time was probably thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars worth of civil defense preparedness stuff. I mean, I found the little iodine tablets and things that had been, and ancient 1950s water barrels with that black and orangey yellow logo on it. It was a fallout shelter in an attic. We weren't prepared for a nuclear holocaust, and we're not prepared for natural disasters. We don't build for them in the areas that are typically stricken by them. On the way through Alabama, I saw, a year and a half later, I saw the remnants of the tornadoes that blew through Tuscaloosa. And it really was. It was a swath a mile wide. In rural parts of Alabama, the kids looked up and said, "What in God's name is this?" I said, "That's what a tornado does." Because entire forests had been rendered into piles of matchsticks. And so, too, had significant portions of places like Tuscaloosa and Phil Campbell. Just erased, because we don't build for them. I guess some you can't build for, but some. We're not ready. We're not even ready for the prosaic stuff, even if the inhofes of the world are correct. We're not ready. But the thing is, you know, beans and rice, as things go, are fairly cheap. As our buddy Kate often notes, it ain't cat food you're after, it's mackerel. They're still a dollar a can. It is possible, because Marty just asked the question, except for a doomsday prepper or a one percenter, who can afford it? Well, do the math. How much rice does a family of four need in a day? Ask China. Ask India. Ask the global south how much beans you need to survive in a day. That magnificent protein source. There is nothing about our culture that is ready for what's coming. Nothing. Except for the 1%. Because the 1% know that they can simply leverage the system as it exists to make sure that it serves their needs while the rest of us go F ourselves. Carl's Jr., F you, I'm eating. They can do it, they have done it, and they will do it. And the one thing that should tell you is, Buster, you're on your own. Sister, if you don't take care of it, ain't nobody gonna take care of you. Because, see, they've won. There is an overarching principle to all of this. You think we're still in the battle, but we're not. They have won. The Ayn Randians and the people who want America to look like Haiti have won. Now they're just cleaning up the mess. Now they're just scraping up the crumbs. They've got their little whisk broom out and their dustpan, and they're scraping the last of the commons into it. As noted, they literally voted today to take food out of the mouths of poor children. Once upon a time, what became the food stamp program was simply known as commodities. And it was then, and still is, managed by the United States Department of Agriculture. It was surplus food. It was food that was bought from the farmers to keep the farmers from going under, and then with all that food sitting around, well, what the hell, let's give it away to poor people. It's welfare. Not the distribution end. The payment end is welfare. But it wound up serving a noble purpose, and guess what they gave away a lot of? Rice, beans, cheese, butter, peanut butter. You think that was an accident? Because it wasn't. It's about 16 minutes past the hour, and, well, there I go again. Well, there I go again. Take a little break, give you a chance to light up the phones if you so desire. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck with more filibustering. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back, 877-443-2366.
Well, I couldn't resist. Donald Fagen, of course, from the Nightfly, New Frontier. It's just a dugout that my dad built in case the Reds decide to push the button down. I think I mentioned that earlier. And in keeping in the same vein, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, 23 minutes past the hour. About 35 minutes left of conversation in the program if you want to get involved. Otherwise, I'll just filibuster. But in the same vein, rice, beans, that sort of thing. You know what America needs? Not a sensible 21st century power grid. Hell no! We need an apple that won't turn brown. Really. Out of the New York Times earlier today in a story by Andrew Pollack. Directly from the article, a small company is trying to bring to market a genetically engineered apple that does not turn brown when sliced or bruised, but it has much of the rest of the apple industry seeing red. Oh, that is clever and catchy, isn't it? The company, Okanagan Specialty Fruits, says the non-browning apple will prove popular with consumers and food service companies and help increase sales of apples in part by making sliced apples more attractive to serve or sell. Well, yeah. I mean, assuming that it hasn't been made not to turn brown by splicing in a gene from a goat's stomach. You remember the Frankenspud, right? The spud, the potato, the plant, the leaf of which, and the potato bug bites the leaf to eat the leaf, and the enzyme from the stomach of a goat that's been spliced into the potato's genomic sequence then kills the bug naturally. I don't know. Goat's okay, but it's kind of gamey, and I don't want goat in my potato. You want goat with fat? The article notes that Americans have been eating genetically engineered food since the 1990s. Not cause for celebration. No, this thing is called the Arctic Apple. And it represents the first genetically engineered version of a commonly grown fruit that people directly bite into. Because, you know, we don't directly bite into a potato. Lo and behold, a lobbying group that's actually a part of industry is opposing it. So, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I guess. That's a hell of a way to go through life. The U.S. Apple Association, representing the American apple industry, is opposing introduction of the product. They say, again, this is a quote from the article. They say genetic engineering, while not dangerous, could undermine the fruit's image as a healthy and natural food, the one that keeps the doctor away and is as American as, well, apple pie. God, the story just wrote itself, didn't it? And there's a balance to be struck here. Because the apple is probably, in competition with maize, the most genetically modified food on the planet. Go to any grocery store. Of course, most of you know this. Go to any grocery store. Buy an apple. Eat the apple. Enjoy the apple. Savor the apple. Love the apple. Be the apple, Danny. Be the apple. Then, when you get to the core, take the seeds. Plant the seeds. It will come up. Most likely. One, at least, will come up. We'll have a little apple tree. After a while, transplant the out of a little cup into a bucket, grow the apple tree for a few more years. It may flower. It may produce an apple. It will not be the apple that you ate. Because the apple has been genetically modified naturally, as is the case with maize. You know, stuff not involving microscopes or scanning electron microscopes or gene splicing for thousands of years. I stand willing to be corrected, but I think the apple first arose in either Persia or Turkey. Somewhere around in there. It has been with us as a cultivated fruit for a very long time, just like the grape, which has also been manipulated. As Michael Pollan writes in The Botany of Desire, the apples that John Chapman, Johnny Appleseed, took down the Ohio River, got off the boat at Marietta, Ohio, and struck west planting orchards, you couldn't have eaten one of those apples on a dare, not on a bet. They were cider apples. They were sour as hell, and they were meant not for pies or for lunchtime fruit-healthy munch snacking, but for cider. So, yeah, the apple has been messed with for practically as long as there's been apples. But this is some sort of industrialism. This is, you know, really, to keep it from turning brown? To keep it from oxidizing in the presence of air? You know, because then you could have bags full of pre-peeled, pre-sliced apples that could just stay indefinitely in your grocer's produce section. Because we as Americans are far too damned lazy to peel an apple. The upshot of the article is that this Friday, a public comment period will open via the Agriculture Department on Okanagan's application for regulatory approval of the genetically modified apple trees. They're also seeking approval for the apple in Canada, where the public comment period just closed. The Okanagan Valley is in British Columbia, by the way. Hi, Psychoticus! He says non-browning apples. The president of the company, Neil Carter, says non-browning apples would boost industry sales, much as baby carrots did for carrot sales. Except for the fact that they're not baby carrots. Stop it! They're whittled down carrots that couldn't pass muster for the regular bagging process. Now, wait for this. Wait for this. This is going to knock you down. We are, after all, talking about an apple, right? This is an apple. No, not the predatory company from California. No. This is a goddamn apple. Neil Carter added, with a straight face, presumably, though that is not there parenthetically. Neil Carter added, a whole apple is for many people too big a commitment. If you had a bowl of apples at a meeting, people wouldn't take an apple out of the bowl. But if you had a plate of apple slices, everyone would take a slice. We cannot have an apple slice gap. Did you hear that? A whole apple is for many people too big a commitment. Well, maybe this has something to do with you've got a bowl of apples sitting in a board meeting where people are working and trying to eat at the same time. Maybe the answer is that an apple wouldn't be too much of a commitment if, in fact, people had a reasonable amount of time in which to nourish themselves before having to go and slave away a little bit more. Of course, that would go against that hated word, that despised word, productivity. Right? What we want is a means by which people can eat some apple and at the same time keep slaving away. I mean, if you bite into the thing, they're juicy, you know, it might dribble onto your spreadsheet. Or dribble into your Uniblab 10,000 laptop, and we can't have that. Apple slices are already becoming more popular as a healthful snack, sold in bags in supermarkets and included by McDonald's in its Happy Meals for Children. Here's the fun part. The slices are often coated with a mixture of vitamin C and calcium to prevent browning and preserve crispness. But that can impart an odd taste to the apples, according to Mr. Carter, who wants to sell a Franken apple. Arctic apples are being genetically manipulated first in the Golden Delicious and Granny Smith cultivars. And no, it's not a goat belly gene. It is a synthetic gene that causes the apple not to produce so much polyphenol oxidase, which makes apples turn brown. I wonder why apples turn brown. Because after all, what we're talking about here is an attempt to defeat biology, an attempt to defeat evolution. Yeah, see, there's Ron being Ron and Raleigh being all commonsensical. Bob, you don't want your apples to turn brown? Put some damn lemon juice on the thing after you slice it. Jeez. Apples and genetic splicing. What could go wrong? Jack in Shreveport asking, Bob, aren't natural apples smaller than the ones we see at the grocery store anyway? I'm not real sure myself. Yes, they are. Maybe having a natural apple would make it easier to eat a whole one at one time. We're talking about a culture that can wolf down extra big-ass fries without thinking about it, but an apple is too much of a commitment. I think the problem is not in the apple. Call me crazy. It's mind-boggling. Jack in Shreveport also adding in regard to disaster preparedness. I may have missed it, but don't forget to add how poorly our communication systems perform in disaster situations. Well, we learned that one the hard way, too. At the very least, the working landlines and cell phone networks become overburdened and people can't get through. Cell tower systems don't have sufficient geographical coverage. During Katrina, even the emergency workers' systems either didn't function or could not be integrated together properly. During Katrina, even emergency services communication systems didn't function sufficiently and didn't integrate together properly. And systems that allow for family members, relatives, and friends to locate each other are ad hoc. One major reason this occurs is that systems are designed for the lowest possible cost with very little margin for error or stress on the system. And government systems are mostly boondoggles and contract ripoffs rather than true solutions. We dot R dot screwed dot. Hard to argue with. We could have been broadcasting on the Tuesday after the disaster. But no. The cable system that feeds the phones and the internet here. Right. So, there's a whole lot of preparedness. But the first thing you got to do is be able to eat and hydrate. Lottie in the chat room. No, natural apples will be a new product that'll get introduced next year. Yeah. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Mr. Bob Kincaid.
Yes.
Andy.
Andy, how are you, buddy?
Can you hear me okay?
I gotcha.
Good. Gee, that's some storm you guys got.
It was brutal. It was weird. Honest to God, I keep saying it, and people say, what? No, I have never seen anything like this. Never.
They don't call you guys the sacrifice zone for nothing, do they?
No, you know, and it's especially fun to kick us once we're down, you know, by holding a golf tournament while people burn up in 100-degree heat.
I'm just kind of incredulous. It's the third world.
Yeah.
really in a developing country.
Oh, no, 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 no. We're not developing.
Regressing. We're digressing.
Yeah, this is Haiti with cable. Unless the power goes out.
Right. Well, the last time I was talking to you, we were talking about one of those Supreme Court cases, the one in Montana, I think it's the American Tradition Partnership versus the state of Montana or versus the Attorney General Bullock. So what'd you think about the one pager from the
floor? Oh, yeah, that came and went in a hurry, didn't it?
Yeah, I think the situation there was, it was whether there would even be testimony taken on that. And, of course, they wouldn't even take any kind of...
No, they were not going to take any risk of
comments.
They were not going to run any risk of reconsidering any portion of Citizens United. Just a one-page memorandum opinion saying, nope, Montana's law got to go.
Right. No discourse, no brief.
Nothing.
No back and forth. No thought process. Right, it was just cut and dry, baby. You guys are SOL. The money in our politics is here to stay. You know, talk about digressing backwards, going back to the 1890s.
1880s? Yeah. Or maybe forever. I mean, money's been in politics forever, has it not, Andy? To one degree or another.
Not at this level.
Was it John Hancock who became a founding father because, among other things, one of his businesses was smuggling? And he was willing to smuggle for the revolution? But no, not to this degree. Now, this is a matter of the rubber mask being off and everything being made completely obvious for anyone who dares to look. This is bought and paid for. This is why you have the voter suppression scams running under the rubric of voter fraud prevention.
Well, what it did was it brought us back to the Teddy Roosevelt era. I believe it was 1906 when the Tillman Act was passed, and that's what the Citizens United wiped away.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Doesn't this effectively reduce that legislation to a nullity?
Right. It nullified the Tillman Act, which was enacted in 1906 under Teddy Roosevelt to stop the corporate funds going into politics, stop corporations from making large contributions. And, of course, Citizens United just wiped that out. So talk about precedent. Meaning nothing. Being totally meaningless to this court.
And the thing is, because of all the foo-frah over the Affordable Care Act and a couple of other things, the Arizona decision, the Citizens United largely flew under the radar, didn't it? I mean, I haven't seen any mass gatherings of 100,000 people around the Supreme Court of the United States over the Montana decision. Have you?
Yeah, it certainly hasn't gotten the airtime and the play in the corporate media. Now, neither did that SEIU case.
No.
Get a lot of fanfare. What was that, Knox versus SEIU 1000? And full disclosure, funny thing about that, I used to be a member of SEIU 1000. That's in California.
Really?
That particular union, yeah. And I was in it when that all came down because we were trying to raise extra funds to go after Schwarzenegger in his campaign. And that's when that all came down when some members of the union who are not truly members, but they're actually represented. They're not members, but they're represented by the union because you have to be... Represent because the union has collective bargaining capabilities. You know, they didn't want to have their money used for campaign contributions, so that all went down. And that was a 7-2 case. There's your liberals on the court coming to the aid of the working class. That was nice, too. I think that was Sotomayor and Ginsburg who actually went along with the rats and Kennedy.
That 7-2, Elena Kagan was in on that too, wasn't she?
I think she was actually on the right side of that.
Was she?
Her and Blyer. I think it was Ginsburg and Sotomayor.
Okay, I don't have the particulars.
Yeah, you can look at it.
But of course, we have to understand that in light of what happened with the mandate side. That was the swap. And it really was a cynical, vicious little piece of bargaining, Andy, because what we got was we got to keep the mandate in exchange for making sure that poor folks didn't get mandatory admission to a universal single payer system, and that really is vicious.
And the other negative about that is the whole thing with Medicaid and having guys like Rick Perry just come out and say we don't need none of this socialism. We don't need any of this Medicaid. The state of Texas is run like friggin' Uganda, for God's sakes, as far as the uninsured go and minimum wage people and people that could really use health care.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of states are going to opt out of increases to Medicaid. So where are a lot of the 30 million new, insurance customers are supposed to come out of the Medicaid rolls. That's my understanding.
No, they're not going to come out of the Medicaid rolls. They're from the ranks of the generally uninsured. Now, a lot of those people might have qualified for Medicaid if states go forward. You know, immediately after the decision came down, the first thing you began to hear from the stand states, from the Confederacy, was, well, we ain't going to do none of that Medicaid stuff.
Right.
And a headline on the here in West Virginia today was, government mulling whether to participate in Medicaid plan.
Right.
Well, you know what? If the coal industry told Earl Ray Tomlin to participate, the headline would have read, Tomlin trumpets state participation in Medicaid plan.
Right. Well, at least that was supposed to give some people insurance. Obama was counting on those being some of the people uninsured that would become insured with the expansion of Medicaid anyway. So that goes down the tubes.
Right.
But yeah, that's our Supreme Court of right-wingers. Another group, you know, putting us back down to, you know, doing their best, darndest, to put us back to the 1890s.
If that.
Yeah, I was looking at my notes, and I actually I have written here that it was Sotomayor and Ginsburg.
I'll be darned.
On the Knox versus SCIU, which surprised the heck out of me. You know, I would have thought Kagan probably would have been one to go along with the right wing of the court, but it was actually Sotomayor and Ginsburg. It's really surprising. Anyway. Well, I'm glad you're back and safe anyway.
Well, there's the back part and then there's the safe part. I wish I could have gotten the whole show done on Friday night the 29th, because that was sort of going to be the trip report, and there was so much in all of that. And then the crap hit the fan, and I don't know if I'm done. I probably am pretty close to done about talking about what happened this past week. But, again, I made a few notes myself, and it just began to all run together, Andy. I had never been through anything like this. I mean, back when Margie was born, we were without power for 2.5 weeks in the middle of the ice storm of the century. That was 1994. But it wasn't like this. It was not like this. It literally came in minutes. The power went out here on the show at about 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, when the grid was knocked out down at the coal-fired power plant at the foot of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And by about 5 more minutes, 10 more minutes, tops, I was watching that thing blow over the hilltop here, And it was the damnedest thing I had ever seen.
Yeah, Jim had made the same comment, that it came on really quick. Was it? It was a windstorm. What was it, like a hurricane?
Yeah, there wasn't even much rain to it. Disaster officials in Virginia, who deal with hurricanes more often than anything like this, said that it was like a hurricane that came without warning.
Wow. You know, it's funny. When I was in Slovakia a few years ago, in one of their resort areas, they had a terrible windstorm that was unprecedented hit before I got there, and I got to see the aftermath of it, like a year after. And they had never seen anything like that happen before. It knocked down, you know, old growth forests there that had been there for, you know, years and years, and never had they ever seen anything like this. And just the damage and the swath of trees just wiped out, you know, just upended right from their roots.
Yeah, matchsticks.
Yeah, and they owed that all to climate change. You know, that's the climate change effect doing that. That's what's totally behind that. Because nobody living had ever seen anything like that happen. And you're getting the same thing. I've never heard of that there.
Generally, if we have winds come through and wreak a little bit of havoc around here, the meteorologists run out and tell us that it was not a tornado, because the minute the winds go up, because we don't experience tornadoes here, people tend to holler, "I seen a funnel cloud," who have never seen a funnel cloud in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the meteorologists run out and explain to us, no, we were hit by straight line winds. So I know what straight line winds are.
Right.
But this was a broad, fast moving agglomeration, I guess, of them. Such that it took down, it blew across Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and it never let up. It didn't blow itself out. And then because of all that flat ground, it gathered energy, and by the time it hit the mountains, I mean, it slammed into us like a bus.
Wow.
And I've talked to some old timers around here, and they say the same thing that I've been saying. Never seen anything like it.
Wow. That verifies that.
Well, I mean, that's good for, you know, that's good for the last 80 years.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we'd better get used to it, and we'd better prepare for it. And get used to it, we might. I don't see how, but prepare for it, Andy. We won't. We won't.
Well, you said a part of the solution would be to decentralize and not have a centralized grid, but get those solar panels up. And get yourself.
Yeah, you know, you may not be able to run your entire household just on your own solar on a decentralized grid, but you would be able to maintain the basics. You might not be able to cook on your stove, but you might be able to keep your fridge cold. You might be able to have a couple of lights go on.
Right. At least you'd have something to be self-contained and not. Be at the mercy.
And if everything's decentralized, then the system that is working can also be rerouted more efficiently and more feasibly than this old dinosaur system that is running most of the country.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, I mean, it seems... I know it would be expensive, and I know it would be... This is the work of 50 years, maybe. This is work on a scale of, say, the interstate highway system. But just to the same extent that the interstate highway system was damned well worth the effort, how could this possibly be less so, Andy?
Right. Well, to get off the subject, I had something I had saved for a while. Did you ever hear a woman named Naomi Camper?
I don't think so.
She's a top lobbyist for J.P. Morgan.
Oh, dear.
in Washington. And guess where she used to work?
J.P. Morgan?
Well, she works for J.P. Morgan now, but she used to be the top staffer for Senator Tim Johnson.
Oh, naturally.
Democrat.
Yeah.
Head of the Finance Committee. You know, again, you look at this garbage and you just see how the government and the financial services industry are just all one and the same.
Yeah, they are.
The Democrats proven they're just as darn corrupt. When you got the top lobbyist, this Naomi Camp, I saw this in a June 13th article. You know, the top J.P. Morgan lobbyist, and she used to work right for Tim Johnson, who's the head of the Finance Committee for the Democrats. You know, what a joke. And then on 6/23, I was reading this article about the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, who actually did a good thing with this LIBOR scandal just recently. One of your callers yesterday was talking about that.
Yeah, that was steady. And I listened to Malloy talking about it last night, too. And I'm still wrapping my head around it. I mean, the degree of fraud, collusion, self-dealing, every bad thing that we talk about within fiduciary relationships has just been pissed on, hasn't it?
Well, look, they have inside information. These guys can make bets on just whether LIBOR, which is a London interbank offer rate, which almost everything is based on in the financial world, derivatives and loans and all kind of a swap contracts and whatever are based on the LIBOR rate. And they can just make bets on the direction, whether it goes up or down on the short term, and reap all kind of money. I mean, to have that knowledge where you're manipulating that rate on a daily basis when they do the calculation of what it's going to be, just to swing it in the direction up or down, knowing that in advance, is a major information source that you can use to make money on. So, yeah, that's why it's totally corrupt, total garbage. When these guys are trying to set the exact pinpoint the rate, but just to guess the direction and know the direction in advance is a windfall for these banks, which is, you know, it's just criminal.
Yeah.
You know, so many municipalities and customers who are doing derivatives contracts or doing municipal bonds or anything, their coupon rate is based on LIBOR. So they screw all these people when they're manipulating that rate.
Jesus.
So that's the shame. I mean, it's really widespread.
And of course, the impression is that the UK still has a few laws in place. Is there any chance of anything coming out of this manipulation in terms of criminal charges or sanctions or anything, Andy?
Well, they actually give credit to the CFTC in the U.S. for breaking that. They're the ones who did the investigation, not the FSA, the Financial Services Administration, is the group in London, like our SEC, that should have been investigating that. But there kind of was some collusion there. So it was actually the U.S. people that brought that to light. But you would hope, but, you know, as usually the way these things go is they just extract these penalties from them, and then they don't admit or deny guilt is the way it usually goes, and nobody, you know, manages.
Right, no harm, no foul, and just bring the ball in from out of bounds and keep playing.
Right, put the money down. But they have to change the whole process. They've been doing, I understand, they've been doing that process since the late 60s.
Jesus.
And it's not based on real transactions. It's based on just submitting bids by all these banks. You know, there's like the 13 largest banks. There's LIBOR all over the world. Japan has a LIBOR. I think there's a Middle East LIBOR. They're based all over the place.
It's a money bourse.
Yeah.
Hey, Andy, I got a roll. We're right at the end of things. I'm glad you called in, though, brother.
All right, yeah. I thought I'd get in a few comments. I was listening.
Absolutely. Well, we will.
Glad you're back, man. Glad you're on.
It's good to be back. Thanks, Andy. Have a good night. We'll talk again soon.
All right.
Bye now.
Take care of yourself. Bye. Bye-bye.
It's our buddy Andy. And we'll probably get into that issue some more. Thanks, everybody, for all you do to keep this going, keep it on the air. Thank you for your kind contributions of both your financial support and your intellectual, moral, and emotional support, your participation with your finite time in this little enterprise. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to Texas Betsy. And thanks, of course, to John Fox, busy, very busy, down in Australia. And ongoing thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks, of course, to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, acheact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.